Hello and welcome back to the Attribution Marketing Podcast powered by LeadsRx. On today's episode, we have Brian Kotliar from HighTouch.com, and Brian is going to break down for us exactly his experience in the marketing attribution and conversion rate improvement industry and how you can take some of those lessons and insights and apply them to your own businesses, projects, and products. So Brian, thank you so much for being on the show. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So we always start out in the same way. Please, just in your own words so I don't butcher it, tell us about your career path, how you got here, what led you to be on this podcast today. Break it down.
For sure. So I've been helping high growth technology companies grow for many years now. It's coming up on into my second decade of it, or latter part of my second decade of it. And it's been a kind of a really wild ride where I've had the good fortune to build a startup, have that startup acquired by another company called Sprinklr, where I helped build Sprinklr. And today they've IPO'd and really successful company. I was able to transition from there to working at a company called Intercom, which powers all those little pop-up bubbles in the bottom right corner of the internet, whether you like them or not. That was us. That is us. Helping that company grow and scale, leading kind of performance marketing there. Transitioning from there, I was able to help a company called New Relic, which is a large publicly traded organization, execute a pretty challenging turnaround where the company was really struggling, and we were able to update the business model to be a consumption-oriented, product-led kind of business model and reactivate growth for that company. And then today I work at a company called HighTouch, where I lead marketing and growth, and I'm helping us, hopefully, hyperscale, and in doing that, helping businesses like the audience here for the call figure out ways to use their data to drive better attribution, better performance marketing, better experimentation, and just overall better kind of data-driven marketing.
So you touched on a couple what should be well-known brand names, and I think we should dive just a little bit deeper. Tell us, if you can, just maybe the macro broad strokes here of some of those turnarounds. I think if you're in the kind of server, hardware, cloud world, you should have heard of New Relic. But I wasn't aware that they struggled and that they turned around. So tell us what you did there, how it worked, and maybe folks can apply that to their projects that might be struggling in this new kind of market. So take it away.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. New Relic's a really fascinating story. It was one of the early developer tooling, developer software darlings that took off with what seemed at the time like magic. It was just like this really simple piece of software you could turn on, and then you could deeply understand the performance of your own applications, what errors they were having, if they were down, why they were down, and so on. Like incredibly valuable capabilities. And developers all around the world had never seen anything like it, and they just fell in love. The company executed really well, built great product, built on that love, and was able to hypergrow and ultimately IPO. And not quite the first wave, but close to the first wave of publicly traded SaaS kind of cloud software businesses. And everything was going well. Now, fast forward a couple of years, and the competitive dynamics of the market started to change quite a bit. Anybody who's had any success in life, you know that other people notice. And as soon as they notice, they start to try and emulate you and surpass you. And so as the market shifted much more toward cloud hosting, things like AWS, Azure, et cetera, new competitors were able to emerge, and it became a real dogfight in that space. Companies like Datadog came about, who's just an incredible company. Companies like Elastic, companies like Sneak, and all these companies. And that, frankly, New Relic didn't adapt very well to the changing kind of technology environment, competitive environment at that time, and growth started to decline. The company went from doubling every year to growing 40% every year to growing 20% every year. So when I joined the company, we were growing single digits. And anyone who knows technology companies knows growing single digits in a publicly traded tech company is, frankly, you're doomed. There's no way to sustain that. You're just going to get bought out by some private equity company or something bad's going to happen, because these companies, their whole business model is predicated on aggressive growth. The whole stock multiple is predicated on aggressive growth. So anyway, I joined as part of a team, ultimately ended up being a new CEO, a new chief growth officer, and a new head of sales, etc. I was part of that team to figure out how do we reactivate growth, because the category was still growing really well. The market opportunity was there, but we weren't seizing upon it the way we'd previously done. And we had a couple sort of key insights. The first was that our pricing model wasn't quite right. So we embraced something called consumption-based pricing versus a prior approach, which was much more oriented around product line-based pricing. where we basically said, we're going to tie how much you pay us to how much value you get. And that was pretty innovative for the category. That was unusual and uncommon even now. And so that the value of that was it gave us a talking point and a wedge to re-engage all these customers that had maybe been leaving us or not really been considering us because they didn't have a reason to look at us because so many quality competitors had emerged. And so it made people stop and think, it's, oh, that's really interesting. I don't know if New Relic's right for me, but I do know that like I'm interested in this way of only paying for stuff I actually use and get value from. So that kind of gave us a wedge to re-engage and to reactivate kind of acquisition. Secondarily, frankly, that also is just genuinely a fair, nice way to price. Isn't it? We all hate paying for stuff we don't use. And people actually started using the product more because they were only going to pay for the stuff they got value from. Nobody minds paying for something they actually use. Problem is when you pay a lot for stuff that sucks or you don't use it. And so that really gave us like a new kind of positioning in the market. Now, the next challenge was we had to figure out, we had to really reinvent the product itself to reflect this new approach. Because the product had been made to be sold as these like bundles of capability. It was adopted in that way and so on. And so there was a lot of work there working across our marketing team, our product development organization, our sales organization to figure out, okay, what needs to change in here and create good feedback loops across the business so that it was an easy to use product, easy to adopt and so on. And so that was a kind of a boatload of work as well, which I'm happy to speak to. And then the last bit, perhaps the most relevant bit for the audience is we had to figure out, okay, we've got the story here. We're fair, we're reasonable, we only charge you for what you use. You get a ton of value. We've got a product that's not perfect at the outset, but every month is getting better and manifesting that value more effectively. Now, how do we go get customers? Because we'd lost the ability to acquire. We just forgot how and lost that mojo. And that was probably the focus, the core thing that I was doing. And I helped stand up and rebuild our advertising motion. We basically shut down all of our ad programs. When I joined and we reinvested in that, rebuilt all of our systems, rebuilt all of our analytics and started spending big money again, where prior to my joining, it was a negligible allocation of budget. And then building out really good deep funnel metrics to understand, is this spend working or not? Is it actually acquiring customers? And I'm pleased to say that we were essentially able to reactivate our digital sort of funnel to acquire customers anew. And that quickly became the primary way the organization acquired customers. So we went from a seller-led acquisition model of like sellers calling on people to what's called product-led growth, where we would acquire initial lands with digital means and then nurture and grow those up into sales accounts. And that was that last missing piece because you can only sell so much to the base you have. You need to acquire long if you're going to grow long-term. That was a lot. I'll pause if you have any questions or reactions to that.
No, I think it's great knowledge. Obviously, we could do 3 or 4 episodes just on that project alone. But I think you've accurately identified that kind of third point, which maybe we can go a little bit deeper on. Assuming that you had changed your pricing model, the product itself, to get, let's just say, the value proposition in place and accurate in that competitive landscape. Let's hold that as the assumption. Walk us through what you did on that digital buying funnel and some of those steps that you took in order to make it perform better and get back into a customer acquisition growth phase by simply spending money on paid media. A lot of times folks will say, if especially in software, acquiring customers with paid media and advertising can be some of the most expensive channels available to you as opposed to SEO and social media and organic and earned media and things like that. But for anyone that's looking to grow and grow rapidly, it sure is helpful to just up the media spend and magically up your customer base. So that's the magic formula. How did you find it?
Sure, absolutely. So like before I jump in, I'll acknowledge all those other things we did too. So we built a growth organization, not just an ads team. And so we needed to explore all these disciplines, but ads played a really big role and they continue to. And so the first thing I think a lot, just my personal approach is I try to go from the foundational capabilities up. And to me, even before we were talking about basic ads and like people jump to, oh, we'll do paid search and we'll have a basic landing page and we'll optimize up. I actually think the real foundation precedes that. To me, the real foundation is your team and your data. You can't spend money if you don't have smart people to manage and optimize and learn from the system. You need to create an organization that can execute these programs and learn from them and optimize over time. I don't know how interesting this is to your audience. We can go into it or not, but like org design type stuff and organizational principles. But I always think people often rush to spend money because they have a problem. Like, oh shoot, we're going to miss our target. We need leads or something. And the problem is, I think if you leap to it too quickly, it's just lighting cash on fire. So you need to start with, do I have the right group in place, the right people to do this? And have I equipped them with the right data to actually understand performance? If you've got that, then it's actually not easy, but fairly straightforward to move to an execution mentality where you're like, okay, now I can run a program, know if it worked, and have a rapid learning loop off it. But if you don't have that, and I've made this mistake, in fact, I even made it at New Relic for a portion of time, where we spent boatloads of money in some channels, and because our ad data feedback loops weren't good enough, we didn't realize that the performance was not yielding what we wanted. So I guess that's my first kind of comment, is starting there, you need, and I am a very in-house minded person. I love having agencies. I work with them in my current role. At New Relic, we use them. They still do since I've left and so on. I'm not against agency, to be clear, but I do think agencies need strong internal partnership and opinionated internal partnership to be successful. So I always look at my team first. Do I have the internal crew with a strategic lens and an operational lens to oversee the work of my agency and my ad dollars? I'll pause. Any questions there, or should I keep moving?
No, you're doing great. I just had a personal experience on the agency side. I think you're absolutely right. If you don't have that kind of internal champion that's guiding the strategy and also checking up on the operational aspects, I think agencies can get off track, not necessarily something they're doing that's nefarious, but it's just a challenge if they're lacking the kind of leadership that I think you're talking about instilling. So I think some good lessons there. But let's move on, I think, to another topic here that we had penciled in on the agenda. I think you've referenced people and a process. And I think that in order to measure all those things, you need to have the right tools. But having a tool isn't necessarily going to solve your problem. For example, you could give me a hammer and a saw, but I'm probably not going to be able to make you very nice looking furniture. The tools require kind of the expertise and the correct approach and the experience to get real value out of it. And so, open-ended question for you, but how can folks look beyond their tools and reevaluate their own process, their own procedures, to learn either what the right tool might be or what the right mental and organizational approach would be to get the most value out of your existing tools? So why are tools not that magic bullet, and Google Analytics 4 isn't just going to give you the answer and you're off to the races? Talk us through that and the challenges.
Sure. Look, like, this is one of my, I don't even know if it's a hot take, but it's just one of my like core beliefs and takes. I talk to people a lot. Just like, stop buying stuff. And not, they don't never buy stuff. Shoot, I sell software. Please buy ours. But my point is, everyone is just always in this rush to acquire the next hammer or saw, thinking that it's going to make them a carpenter. And the truth is, a carpenter will take the world's worst hammer or saw and make you something better than you or I will ever make if we're not a carpenter. And real marketers of products, vendors in general, and service providers in general, like, it behooves us. We have an incentive to act like everyone is just one tool away. But you're always one tool away, is the thing I talk to everyone I advise, every person I mentor, everyone on my team when they want to buy a new thing. There are benefits to adding technology, but I've never heard of, I know zero people who added something to their stack and suddenly their problems went away. It's always that you had a strategy, you had a behavior, you had a plan, and the tool was necessary to execute that. And so to me, what I think about, and I guess you could classify this as a tool or not, but I think it's a slightly different thing, is you need to have a perspective of what your ad strategy is. So I'll use the New Relic example again, because we've talked about it so much. So our offer, the critical offer we had that we knew was a market moving, if we could just get it in front of enough people, was that we could offer like a huge amount of value to these software developers. I won't get into the details of it because it's not important to the audience, but if they just signed up for free, we essentially took a bunch of stuff that otherwise would be gated behind credit cards and salespeople, and we moved it to the front and said, it's only gated by an email address. Just try it, just get in there. And so we had this incredibly compelling offer. So first, we had a great offer. Next, we had to figure out who we're going to show this offer to. And that was a data problem. Who is the correct audience, and where is that audience findable across the internet? That wasn't a tool thing. That was a depth of understanding of our buyer thing. And then next, we needed to actually execute programs to show it to people. And so that required us to go, yes, of course, work with ad tech providers, work with ad platforms and so on to actually execute the programs and run the ads and see if they work. Now, that last bit of see if they worked is really interesting because it's not trivial, especially often in B2B where the buying cycles are long. People will, the lifetime value is different than the initial acquisition. And so there's some complexity there to figuring out what it means to work. And that goes back again to data. And we invested a ton, and I always invest a ton in every team I lead, in building up a really rich set of information to help me understand, are my ads working? And so to that end, what my big aha moment was in my past role, which has changed what I who I am as a marketer, candidly, is the power of the data warehouse. It's not a thing that most marketers are familiar with. I personally, I don't know how to write SQL queries. I don't actually know like how to structure tables and data in a warehouse. Lord knows I'm like wildly unqualified to do that. But what I learned in my last couple of jobs at Intercom, at New Relic, here at Hightouch, is that you can do stuff in a data warehouse from an analytical perspective that is like literally impossible in any other environment. And so you can take data, like giving my example, a free signup, you can use the data warehouse to look at all of the attribution associated with that, not just like the literal click path that occurred, but other people that work at that same business who may or may not have signed up, things that they did offline that you can't see in your typical kind of UTM parameter trail, behaviors they've taken in the product that look like things that other people have done in the product and start to model, do matching of behaviors and do make predictions and things. All these really cool things that you can do with all the riches of the data warehouse that just don't exist elsewhere. And so since then, the data warehouse has actually become more so than any ad tech technology, any email technology, any CMS or website or A/B testing technology. The data warehouse has actually become the most valuable tool to me. But I struggle to even describe it as a tool because all it is, it's a data repository. You just have to use it. And using the data in these new ways, it's a kind of a foreign behavior. It was to me before I started, but it that to me is the big unlock. It's not like looking at somebody else's MarTech diagram and saying, oh, I wonder if I should buy this ABM tool, or oh, I wonder if I should. That to me is not the thing. The thing is really getting close to the data and all the rich potential of the data that we've got, but don't really use.
Well said. So talk us through, I think, just your ideas on marketing data today and the best way to manage it. And I'll give you a little more clarity on the question here. Obviously, 5 years ago, you could get third-party data from cookies and rent it, let's say, from Google and Facebook and Apple, who were fine to share what folks were doing across various apps or websites. And they'd let you get very granular targeting, remarketing, and all that good stuff that's driven digital marketing for the past decade, let's say. But as I am sure you are aware, a lot of that stuff is going away, or cookies are being depreciated, or Apple is asking apps not to track your data. We always recommend that folks position themselves now into a first-party data ecosystem. You want to be able to track your own customers, have people in your own database, your own data warehouse, and we wanted to get your perspective on that. I see a future where Best Buy and folks like that don't let you browse their e-commerce store until you log in and make your account so that they can track you and give you those personalized recommendations and improve the product and experience that you have on that Best Buy website. So what are your thoughts on that privacy backdrop and regulation that we're all facing, third party versus first party, and how organizations can future-proof those challenges that are coming? And I realize that larger companies, especially software tech companies, are going to have a leg up here, both in their understanding, but more importantly, in their ability to execute on some of those things. So give us the highest level perspective, or explain it to me like we're in first grade here, about how any organization should be looking at this challenge. What steps should they deploy to address it? And how are folks going to improve their marketing and data warehousing going forward in this kind of ever-changing marketing landscape?
It's a great question, and it's an urgent one, right? We're all so reliant on these things, and it feels like the ground is shifted beneath our feet. So first of all, I wholeheartedly agree with you that every company, regardless of size or complexity, needs to start if they're not already, really actively engaging with the data that they have consent for and they've acquired. And if they're not acquiring permission-based quality first-party data already, they need to start. Now, the good news is most companies are, they've got at least a newsletter, they've got some stuff, but accelerating that and taking it much more seriously than perhaps you did previously, I think is the first step. It's a mindset shift and a realization that, look, I firmly believe that we'll be able to rent audiences indefinitely, but how that works, the ability to rent audiences really effectively and have that just be the underpinnings of your ad program, that those days are numbered. What seems to be happening is that companies, how do I put this? All the companies, and I include media companies in this, are shifting towards a first-party data mindset. What data do I have oversight to and insight to? What data do I have permission and consent for? And now the challenge becomes, okay, great. How do I organize that information? And a data warehouse is just a fancy term for those of us that are not like analysts by trade, which I am not. It's just, if you imagine a giant spreadsheet with just like thousands of worksheets, that's basically all it is. And it's ways to like do simple VLOOKUPs and compares across spreadsheets. But just imagine it at this incredible scale. So it's like a spreadsheet on crazy steroids. That's basically all a data warehouse is. And so people need to start to gather all that first party data in a central place. The reason I say that is that literally actually doing this in a bunch of different spreadsheets or even somewhat sophisticated across like an email tool and a CRM and this and that, it just doesn't work very well. The data becomes really unmanageable, difficult to access, difficult to compare and contrast and understand what you've got in there. And that's why people are moving towards just dumping it all into these centralized places, which in this case is a data warehouse. And they're not that expensive or complex to set up anymore. It used to be these crazy projects. But like companies like BigQuery, the product from Google, Snowflake, of course, we've all heard of, they've made this technology much more accessible. It's still a little foreign to your average marketer, I'll acknowledge that. But compared to 10, 15 years ago, it's not even close. The technology is much more accessible, much easier to use, and it's getting more that way every day. And just to again, go back to my simple framing here, you need to start collecting this information. You need to start dumping it into a central place where you can manage the permissions, consent, and quality of it. And then you need to start looking at it to understand what's there. Now, the cool thing is, just as we're all doing that, the media companies and the publishers are doing the same thing. New York Times is doing that with all their data. As your example, Best Buy is doing that with all their data. Small e-commerce companies are doing that with all the data. Everyone is in mass beginning to do this more and more because they have to. The cookies are going away over time, and the quality of the data associated with those cookies is getting worse. This starts to introduce some really neat stuff you can start to do, where there's these concepts, forgive me, this is going to get a little, it's a strange word, a word I myself didn't know 2 years ago. It's called a data clean room. It's a simple idea though. It's the idea that what if I could mostly anonymize my bundle of spreadsheets and you could mostly anonymize your bundle of spreadsheets, and then we could compare overlap between them and share data, but in a way that respects privacy. It's a really interesting idea. If we all have a little nexus of first party data, can we start to share and help one another? And the most interesting thing is the media and the publishers have started to do this. So I don't know if the New York Times does this, but just using them as an example, if they have a list of customer IDs and I have a list of customer IDs and I want to figure out if my customer IDs I want to market to are available in the New York Times publishing thing, I used to do this all through cookies. The cookies are gone. So what do I do instead? I use these matchmaking technologies, these clean rooms and other things to figure out, is my audience on the New York Times? And then if they are, now I can work with New York Times to buy ad impressions to reach that audience. That's the next generation of this that we're seeing. My company, Hightouch, one of the products we've made, and I don't mean to make this a plug, I want to use it to explain, like we actually have a product that helps people do that comparison in what we call match boosting. It's looking at your data and boosting the match rate to companies like New York Times or companies like Facebook or whatever to find your people over there. And it's the idea of this bridging technology between what we used to have, which is just show up at New York Times with a bundle of cash and they'll give you access to the audience you want. That's not possible anymore. Now you have to show up to them with some data of your own and you can use that data to find people on the New York Times and elsewhere. And so a whole new ecosystem of capabilities needs to emerge to facilitate that. But it starts with you as a marketer having some data. And so the urgent thing is to figure out what you've got, get it organized. It could just literally be in a spreadsheet, but typically you'll do it in something a bit more sophisticated than that. And then start to figure out where you can find those people elsewhere and how you can find those people elsewhere. And that might be where you need to start buying technology, that last step, but not necessarily the first one.
Right, well said. And I think you got a nice segue here. So just tell us about High Touch, a project that you're on now, how it all works, and just finish it off, please, with where folks can follow you. Maybe that's LinkedIn or Twitter, and where folks can learn more information about High Touch.
Sure. To put a bow on it, I bought this product in my prior role at New Relic because it was really helpful. And I've subsequently now helped many companies adopt this product, and it's tied very much to what we've been talking about. It's the idea that once a company sort of awakens to this first party data and wants to use it, they're typically going to put it in a central place. The problem is that central place is not built for marketers. I myself could not access directly any data in those tools. I'm not even all that good at Excel, frankly. So what we need as marketers is an interface to all this amazing data that we're starting to gather and insights we've started to produce that we can use day to day to make our ads work better. And so that's what High Touch is. High Touch is a really simple and easy to use interface for all this data that's in the back office of our businesses so that marketers like you or I can execute programs on the front end. And the example I always give that's just like comically simple, but almost nobody does it, whether you're at a little company or I meet with Fortune 50 companies that don't do this, is just ad suppression. I don't want to show ads to people that cannot buy or have already bought that product. I either want to show them for the next product I want them to buy or no ad at all. And in doing that, I remove a ton of waste and my ROAS instantly goes up. But most people, they do suppression audiences once in a blue moon by downloading a spreadsheet and uploading a spreadsheet. What if all of that data on who you need to suppress is just sitting in a central place and there's a really simple, friendly interface to let you do it on the front end? That's the most basic use case that pretty much everyone who buys High Touch starts with. And it solves the simple problem of, I just don't suppress often enough. And so I have a shitload of waste, excuse my language, that I'm living with. And it's crushing my ad program. And so, yeah, that's basically what we do. We go into these businesses and we say, you've got data, you're not using it. Here's a simple thing you can do with it. Remove ad waste. Here's another simple thing you can do with it. Improve your ad targeting. Here's another simple thing you can do with it. Improve your personalization and so on. And the thing just works. I bought it, loved it, and now I work the company that makes it because the thing just works. So yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry to be so evangelical about it, but it makes me crazy when people don't do things like suppress ad audiences. Or they do, but they only upload the suppression list once every 30 days. That means for 29 days, you were wasting money. That might have been a whole person's salary in those 29 days if your budget's big enough. So I don't know how you get about this, but I get pretty worked up.
I think it's good to be passionate about your product and the problem that you're solving. So that's going to help you sell it for sure and have folks believe in what you guys are doing. So just give us a quick sign off, Brian. If marketers out there need help and support in this regard, how can they get in touch with you or sign up for a demo? Get a little plug going for yourself and then we'll wrap it up.
Sure. Look, if you're all interested in what we do or even just to learn about this, because we write a lot about it on our blog and in our resources and stuff, just go to hightouch.com. It's just tons of information about this kind of idea of first-party data and a central source of truth. And if you're looking to track me down at all, you can just find me. I'm just at brian@hightouch.com or on LinkedIn at Brian Cotlier. And I'm pretty responsive and I'm always eager to chat or help anyone I can. A lot of people have done me a lot of favors over the years, so I'm always ready to help others.
You heard it here first, folks. Thank you so much to Brian from High Touch. You can find him on the website, drop him an email, or connect on LinkedIn. This is the Attribution Marketing Podcast, signing off.